Thanks very much. This is, a big thank you to Will and to Alan for moderating the session, and to Sevgi and Ned and Gail for inviting me to speak. I think this is probably the most people who've ever been in a room at 8 o'clock in the morning to hear about genital immunology. So I think it's a bold step to put it first, but as I was saying to Will, it's probably less bold if you know there's free breakfast out there, because even the speaker might not have made it if it wasn't for the free breakfast out there. So thank you for coming. We have an interest in my lab in talking about genital infections and mucosal immunology, particularly because of HIV transmission, and I'll talk about why that's important. I was also asked to speak a bit about systemic immunology, i.e. blood immunology, but I have to say up front that there's much less impact on systemic immunology and a lot on the genital tract, so that's really what I'm going to be focusing on. And I don't know if I needed to have a slide about disclosures, but I can happily or unhappily say up front I have no disclosures whatsoever. So why do we worry about the immune effects of genital infections? And I think a lot of the time I'm going to be talking about lots of things that we haven't really seen in the real world to be associated with HIV risk, and we may not know if they have been what to do about them in the real world in terms of reducing that HIV risk. But there are definitely a couple of studies looking at very simple markers of genital immunology that show that it's important in terms of HIV susceptibility. So if we're talking about women, and we do actually have similar data from men in terms of foreskin immunology, but there was very nice work from the Caprisa group that I'll show you a slide on afterwards in South Africa, showing that elevated pro-inflammatory cytokines in the female genital tract, so in the vagina, were associated with increased risk of HIV acquisition. And a while ago, we had some data from Kenya showing that if you look at innate antimicrobial peptides, particularly LL37, one of the cathelicidins, one of these innate antimicrobial peptides made by epithelial cells and the alpha defensins by neutrophils, again, when they respond to pathogens, elevated levels of those were associated with an increased risk of HIV acquisition as well. And I always like that latter piece, because actually if you take those individual things, if you take a genital secretion sample from a woman who has high levels of alpha defensins or LL37, it's able to neutralize HIV in the test tube. But actually, if you follow that woman forward, she's at an increased risk of getting HIV, which again shows you right up front some of the dichotomies that we get into when we start looking at mucosal immunology and HIV risk. So I don't want people to read all of this, but I do want to actually put it up with the numbers. One of my many mentors up in Canada, Jay Keystone, gives a talk about how to give a talk, and you're not supposed to do this, put on a slide that has all these things that you can't see. But this up here is a list of all the cytokines in that Caprisa study that were associated or not associated with HIV risk in their cohort. And I just want to highlight that one of these stars is IP10 here, which again is one of these chemokines that can be important in terms of recruiting T cells and other activated immune cells to the genital tract. Was one of the most strongly associated with HIV risk, as well as some other cytokines that you can see listed. And overall, when they pooled all these things together and said, let's make a score of this and talk about how, whether a woman has inflammation or non-inflammation, there was about a threefold increased risk of HIV acquisition if you had at baseline inflammation in that genital tract. And you'll see later on why I highlight that IP10. So here's a cartoon from Tony Fauci, who some people down here may have heard of, looking at how HIV crosses the genital barrier. Obviously, the first thing that I don't have to tell people is that most of the time when somebody gets exposed to HIV, they don't become infected. On the minority, the 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 times that somebody exposed to HIV does become infected, that virus has to first cross the barrier here, so get across the epithelial barrier, and an intact epithelial barrier is an important defense against HIV acquisition. Most of those viruses don't seem to find, either can't cross or don't seem to find a target cell underneath to infect. The key target cell that they want are these activated CD4 T cells. So again, when you have enough activated CD4 T cells at the site of exposure, that's a key determinant of whether you get infected or not when you've been exposed to HIV, and that's been very well defined in primate models by a number of investigators. Then this takes a little while, and obviously this is the time when we're giving people post-exposure prophylaxis to try and abort that process. Once the process has established itself and we get a viral reservoir established systemically, with the exception of one case to date, it's too late to do anything about that in terms of preventing that HIV infection. So what's mucosal inflammation actually doing? So we know from those field studies that if you have high levels of cytokines in the genital tract, that's associated with increased risk. And so Lyle McKinnon, who used to be a postdoc in my group and now is a scientist first at CAPRISA and now in Manitoba in Canada, did a nice study where we recruited about 100 Kenyan women and looked at whether or not there was inflammation in the genital tract, defined in a very similar way to what CAPRISA had done, and then said what's going on in terms of HIV risk parameters. So the first thing you see, which I think is probably not that surprising, is that if you have elevation in these inflammatory cytokines, you have more CD4 T cells here. And when you collect a cervical cytobrush and count the number of cells present, which is a crude but easily performed and easily repeatable way of looking at cell populations in the genital tract. So here we're just seeing the number of CD4 T cells per cytobrush, and here we're seeing women with inflammation and without inflammation, and there's a strong association with having more cells. And I think that makes sense, and if you look at, if you go back to those data I presented previously about cytokines are associated with more risk, LL37, these other innate antimicrobial peptides are associated with more risk, you see a nice association in all of this. This is work from Toronto that Brett in my lab did recently. You look at the number of CD4 T cells and the levels of IL-8, classic cytokine associated with inflammation, LL37 or HNP1-3 is actually the alpha defensins. All those things that we've seen associated with HIV acquisition, we see a nice correlation with more CD4 T cells that would be susceptible to HIV in the genital tract. You see the same thing actually in the foreskin. And again, we tend to think most of these studies are focused much more on the female genital tract, largely because it's easier to collect scrapings and cytobrushes and biopsies from an ectocervix than it is from a penis. And the sample size of any study that's trying to do that to a penis tends to be fairly small. But because we know that HIV is prevented by circumcision, we actually have a number of programs that are looking at foreskin tissues and tying that in with HIV risk parameters in the foreskin and immunology in the foreskin. And it's much less tight correlation, but you do again see a correlation between, a number of inflammatory cytokines in the foreskin and the density of CD4 T cells underlying the tissue in that foreskin. You also see actually an association with neutrophils. And similar to women, there's a nice association between inflammation in that foreskin, levels of interleukin-8 and other cytokines, and actual HIV acquisition in the field. So I haven't shown you those data, but we do have those data just put together. So what else might inflammation be doing in the genital tract? And to look at that, we worked, again, this is Kelly Arnold from MIT, and also Adam Birchner, who's one of these proteomics guys in Manitoba, and I'm not going to try and tell you how he does his proteomics. Basically, Kelly was the mathematical brain who looked at the analysis for this, because the analysis is very complex. And Adam is a very well-known, well-respected in the mucosal immunology field proteomics person who then says, what proteins are present in the genital secretions? And what you see fundamentally is that if you are inflamed, if you're in that subset who have inflammation, you have elevated levels of certain cytokines. And the higher up you go here, the more of an outlier these different proteins are, so proteins rather than cytokines. And if you're not inflamed, again, you have elevated levels of others. And so then you can go in and say, oh, let me look at these most extreme examples here that are really different between the women who have inflammation and don't have inflammation. And again, I'm even colorblind, so I won't even be able to explain these color maps. But what we see is that upregulated, increased in the genital tract of women with inflammation, are neutrophil proteases. That makes sense because neutrophils come to the genital tract when you have inflammation. Cell motility proteins, that makes sense because we're bringing cells to the site of that inflammation. And you see downregulation of antiproteases, which may make sense, but keratinization and epithelial differentiation markers. So again, this is a proteomic signature of epithelial damage. And indeed, I haven't shown you the pictures, but with Charu Korshik in Hamilton in Ontario, if you take cytokines and you drop them onto an epithelial monolayer model of female genital tract epithelium or gut, it basically makes that epithelium fall apart. So that these cytokines do seem to be quite good, first at recruiting T cells and other cells that may be susceptible to HIV, and also at making that epithelium fall apart. So basically damaging two of those things that are key defenses against HIV acquisition. So how do mucosal infections and STDs tie into this? We know that inflammation increases HIV-susceptible cells, decreases barrier integrity. I think we all realize that STDs and other genital infections are going to be important drivers of inflammation. So what are the effects of specific STDs, and what can we do about it, more importantly? So I, I'm... In the interest of time, I took out my stuff about the classical STDs, gonorrhea, chlamydia, etc., and I'll explain why, but we do know that when we treat those, the numbers of cells goes down, the inflammatory cytokines go down quite nicely. And I'm going to focus today on herpes in the genital microbiome. I had schistosomiasis in there because we've got some great data around Lake Uganda for what schistosomiasis might be doing, but again, I probably won't bore you with that, but just in the interest of getting everything in. So the reason why I'm focusing on the genital microbiome and herpes in part comes from great data from Scott McClelland and others who've been working in Mombasa now for many years, looking at HIV risk in high risk HIV acquisition in high risk Kenyan women in the coast. And what you see here is, again, there are four blocks of time. I've probably made this black and white so you can't even see the colors because I can't see them. So too bad. I'm making you also see black and white. So and you're seeing that over time, basically, what is driving the population attributable risk for HIV is very largely herpes. So herpes 2, either prevalent herpes 2 or incident herpes 2, you can see is responsible for a lot of that HIV acquisition, or bacterial vaginosis and intermediate flora. And so really those are going to be the two conditions I'm talking about today. If you look at gonorrhea, trich, chlamydia, etc., those are really much smaller players, despite this being a high-risk cohort of women who are involved in commercial sex and but have these prevention programs put in place that reduce rates of those STIs. So if we look at asymptomatic herpes, again, I'm preaching to the converted. Everybody knows herpes is very common. Most herpes that's out there in terms of herpes 2 is asymptomatic, so 90% plus asymptomatic. But herpes also, both in the U.S., and we see the same thing in Canada, rates much higher in terms of prevalence and incidence in our African and Caribbean community. So this is actually working with Women's Health and Women's Hands, which is a clinic in Toronto focused on the African and Caribbean community and obviously women from that community. And what we see if we collect blood and just look at systemic immunology is that if you're herpes seropositive without any symptoms, the circles here are women who have no herpes, and the solid circles are women who are HSV2 seropositive. You see much higher expression of this alpha-4 beta-7, which is a homing marker. Basically, this is something expressed on T cells that means those T cells are on their way to a mucosa, either to the gut or to the genital tract. And you see in the blood that T cells, particularly activated CD4 T cells that are expressing CCR5 and other markers of HIV susceptibility, are expressing much higher levels of this mucosal homing marker, meaning that they're on their way, presumably, to the mucosa. And that is true if you then look in the mucosa, and again, I won't show you all the different bits of data that we had, but CD38 HLA-DR is a kind of classic marker of immune activation. So a cell that is expressing those markers is felt to be immune activated, and we see that there's both an increased number in the cervix of CD4 T cells that are activated, and also a greater percentage of those cells, of CD4 cells, are activated and expressing this marker in the cervix. So what we see in the blood does imply that those cells are on their way to the genital tract. Interesting, when we looked at cytokines, we didn't see any difference in cytokines. That Caprisa data saying that more cytokines are associated with HIV, probably not being driven by herpes, although herpes is very common in that community in South Africa. So we then thought that, so TJ Yee, who's one of the grad students in the lab, came in and he was going to do a study looking at the impact of valacyclovir, so the ability of valacyclovir, our treatment for herpes, to reduce or even abrogate these immune changes. So he did a double-blinded placebo-controlled crossover trial, a small number of women, and fundamentally what we see is that if we give somebody placebo or valacyclovir, have a washout period, and then do the opposite, and look at what happens over time, there's no impact whatsoever on number of CD4 T cells in the genital tract, and I haven't shown you the data, but no impact on genital cytokines either. And if you actually look at the number of cells expressing CCR5 or some of these activation markers, there's a tendency to express more of them when you're in the herpes treatment arm. So, you know, I've had some discussions with people about why that might be. Is the valacyclovir dose too low? I don't think it's likely that dose is too low. And there are two things out there that suggest that. Number one, Larry Corey and Anna Wald and the group from Seattle have done some great studies looking at high-dose valacyclovir, and we know that even at 3 grams a day, which is much higher than we use clinically, we still see asymptomatic reactivation of herpes more than a day a month, so that there's relatively frequent reactivation if you look. And if you look at an ulcer, and again that's work from Larry Corey with a very dedicated group of volunteers in Seattle, if you look at an ulcer and you take sequential biopsies from the site of a herpes ulcer, we know that inflammation and increased numbers of CD4 cells where you had that ulcer lasts for at least a month, 2 months after that ulcer has cleared. So that if you have frequent reactivation, even in the context of ultra-high doses of valacyclovir, and this persistent inflammation after reactivation, I don't think that our current drugs basically are good enough to reverse the immune changes we're seeing. And that's probably why the clinical trials have failed to see an impact of herpes suppression on HIV transmission. So what about the microbiome? And I know that David's going to be talking about the microbiome in much more detail, so I'm not going to talk about microbiome and actual risk other than this slide. The crude way that we have of looking at the microbiome is a Nugent score, so a Gram stain with a Nugent score. And again, everybody here probably knows more about how to read those Gram stains than me, so I won't go into it. But fundamentally, we're looking for more diversity, so more Gram-negative bacteria and fewer big Gram-positive rods, those lactobacilli. And if we look at the microbiome defined that way, this is just a meta-analysis that came out a couple of years ago from Nicola Lowe and colleagues showing that there's about a 50% increase in HIV acquisition if you have intermediate flora and about a 60% increase if you have bacterial vaginosis consistently over a very large number of women in this individual level meta-analysis. And again, in that study from Scott and others, it was about 20% of the HIV population attributable risk was intermediate flora or HIV. And I think David's going to be talking much more about the microbiome studies in men and women that have linked the microbiome with HIV acquisition. If you take, you're going to hear much more about those methods, basically I have a very small and simple mind, so I can't do much with the data that we get from these microbiome studies, but the easy thing to do with those microbiome studies, rather than just say that somebody has bacterial vaginosis or no bacterial vaginosis, is you can divide people. The computer will divide based on the pattern of bacteria present in the genital tract. It'll divide them into these community state types. And so Jacques Ravel is one of the, and Powell and his lab is a group that have done some fantastic work with this, and we collaborated with them, again, looking at women from the African and Caribbean community in Toronto. And what you see is, so this community state type 1 is one and 2 are the good ones, so this is predominated by Lactobacillus crispatus, 2 is Lactobacillus gasseri, 3 is Lactobacillus inners, so even though this is a Lactobacillus, it's felt to be a less healthy lactobacillus, and there's a lot of crossover between bacterial vaginosis and lactobacillus inners. And then community state type 4 is this a diversity community state type. So again, strong interaction with intermediate flora and bacterial vaginosis. So we see very similar distribution of these types in ACB women in Toronto compared to what you guys see in the U.S., and that fits with higher rates of genital microbiome diversity and bacterial vaginosis within the African and Caribbean community. Now, if you look at, this is the good microbiome, and if you look at what's happening to the, who has inflammation within that a community state type, nobody does. Community state type 3, this is the inners predominant flora, we see inflammation in about a fifth, and then almost half of those who have community state type 4 have inflammation defined in a very similar way, again, to that Caprisa group. So herpes doesn't seem to be driving inflammation in terms of these cytokines, but bacterial vaginosis certainly does seem to be doing that. And again, Doug Kwan from Harvard has shown some nice data showing that may be particularly driven by interleukin-1, where dendritic cells are basically chewing up TLR4, which is one of these ligands on bacteria in that microbiome and producing these inflammatory cytokines. We don't see an association, though, with T-cell changes with the microbiome in the genital tract at all. So the impact they have on genital immunology seems to be quite distinct. So we then did a study looking, again, this is the new data that hasn't been published anywhere yet, but we're very interested in it. So an observational study giving Flagyl, our standard therapy. The dose is actually slightly different in Kenya in terms of, I think it's 400 twice a day, to Kenyan women with bacterial vaginosis, HIV uninfected women. And the primary endpoint, this was Vinit, who's a student in the lab, was looking at virus entry into CD4 cells collected in the cervix as a percentage, and we have a tool, this pseudovirus tool, that can actually measure how many cells in the cervix are able to be infected by HIV. And then the secondary endpoints, we're looking at other immunology markers in the genital tract. And so what he sees, you give somebody bacterial vaginosis and you look at themselves 1 month later, we try and use the same stage of the menstrual cycle. You've cleared BV in only about half the women. And we see some minor reductions in CD4 T-cell susceptibility, but not that exciting. What's interesting is that if you look, again, only about half the people cleared. So overall, interleukin-1, which is the classic associated with bacterial vaginosis, does go down significantly. That's only in the group that clear. So these figures are going to be, there's a couple of figures coming up. We're on the left. We have these are the women where the bacterial vaginosis cleared by Nugent score, and on the right, the women who didn't clear. And you see, not surprisingly, perhaps, but a very nice definition, you see, oh yes, these inflammatory cytokines, the IL-1 alpha and beta, really go down in the women who clear, but not those who don't clear. Interestingly, if you look at a bunch of other cytokines and chemokines, and we weren't expecting to see this, you see quite dramatic increases in women after they clear bacterial vaginosis. So again, this is IP-10, which is why I was highlighting IP-10 at the start, as one of those being most associated with HIV risk in South African women. We see these very dramatic 2 or 3 log increases in IP-10 levels after clearing bacterial vaginosis, and also MIG and a number of other cytokines. I've got them listed here. So a number of those were associated actually with increased HIV risk in the CAPRISA study. So just to summarize, again, I know that's not necessarily, it's very clear in terms of the data, may not be a clear message in terms of what we should be doing in the field, but genital infections and a microbiome that's characterized by diversity, whether you call that bacterial vaginosis or use the fancier methods that we now have for microbiome analysis, those increase HIV risk. They may have some minor systemic immune effects, but they have big genital tract immune effects, and that includes bringing in more cells that are susceptible to HIV and also reducing epithelial integrity. Treating these, the treatment effect is sometimes complicated, and again, I think that particularly for the bacterial vaginosis story, rather than saying that we should be screening everybody for asymptomatic bacterial vaginosis and treating as a way of preventing HIV, it probably will, unfortunately, be important to actually do some studies where we say, what actually is the clinical impact of reducing this? We seem to reduce some things that look bad, but we actually have unexpected increases in some other cytokines or chemokines that have been associated with risk. And other mucosal infections may be important. You know, stay tuned. We're just starting to look at schistosomiasis, particularly gut schistosomiasis, and interestingly, treating that seems to have some very interesting effects on genital immunology. So there's a lot of people I need to thank. Wangari and Jamie from the Women's Health, Women's Hands Clinic, our collaborators in Kenya, who've been great collaborators forever, Lyle and Adam at the University of Manitoba. I could go on. University of Maryland, Jacques and Powell, our Ugandan colleagues, Lance and Cindy are doing the foreskin and previously semen microbiome work with us, et cetera. And here are the people who did all that work, the most important people. Vineet has developed a pseudovirus assay and did that BV study that I think is very interesting. Brett did a lot of the herpes immunology work. Jessica's been doing, and Ronald have been doing a lot of the foreskin immunology work in Uganda. And Kamnoosh has run all our cytokine assays, although sadly she just left my lab for a better offer. So thanks very much for your attention.